The following is a special WABE news broadcast on the Ebola outbreak and Atlanta's response.
Ebola is a serious disease. It's only spread by direct contact with someone who's sick with the virus. It's a severe disease which has a high case fatality rate, even with the best of care. But there are core, tried-and-true public health interventions that stop it.
You treated me with expertise, yet with such tenderness and compassion.
While this is a day for celebration and gratitude, I ask that we not lose focus on the thousands of families who continue to labor under the burden of this disease in West Africa.
From WABE News in Atlanta, I'm Dennis O'Hare.
And I'm Rose Scott. The Ebola virus is not new. It was first documented in 1976. It was named after the Ebola River in Central Africa. But this current outbreak is concentrated in the West African countries of Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone.
And it has killed more people than all the previous Ebola outbreaks combined. Now, it began to take shape in early March when Doctors Without Borders and Guinea's Ministry of Health started looking into what they called Ebola clusters. By mid-March, a few Ebola patients crossed the Guinea border into Liberia, and they sought treatment in a remote hospital in Voinjima, a small town in northern Liberia.
And that happened to be the same time WABE reporter Jim Burris was in Voinjima. He was in Liberia looking at how that nation has taken years to recover from its brutal civil war. Now, Jim didn't know it at the time, but he was at the very hospital where those first Ebola patients sought treatment the same week they arrived.
It's eerie, haunting even, to hear this now.
Can I just get a quick tour?
Yeah. I'm waiting.
I recorded this audio on March 15th at Voinjima's Telawanyan Hospital. My tour guide is Luana Korva. She's a mental health practitioner at the hospital.
So as we walk, describe what we're seeing.
This is a corridor leading into the hospital.
Telawanyan is a maze of concrete, ramshackle by Western standards. The grass outside is either dead or overgrown.
Generator beating, and that ahead of us is the kitchen.
Inside, it's dark. Only the lab and a few of the rooms have electricity. That comes from a generator outside. There's no air conditioning here in the overcrowded pediatric ward, or most other places in the hospital for that matter.
Yeah, bending left is the medical surgical ward.
Luana points out that to our left is the medical surgical ward. For some reason, we don't head down that corridor. It's likely where the Ebola patients would have been housed.
That was the emergency room?
Yeah, that was the emergency room.
I have to ask because the tiny room with its faded wood desk, two cots, and a cloth divider looked nothing like any ER I'd seen.
How do you feel about the conditions and the quality here? Are they good?
Of course, yes, the hospital condition. Mm-hmm. Of course, yes, as you can see, the place is well clean, decent, like...
Telawanyan is clean, but its ability to provide quality care is limited. Much of the hospital struggles to keep the most basic supplies. Luana later tells me she's almost out of psychotropic medication. She isn't confident more will arrive in time to meet her patients' needs. The next day, I start to feel sick. My temperature climbs to 103, and I have horrible diarrhea. I head back to that same ER I'd glanced past just one day ago. I'm too weak to walk on my own, so two people support my underarms and help me inside. As I lie in one of those two cots, I struggle to maintain consciousness. I can't muster the energy to object to the IV line a nurse is about to put into my hand. She wears no gloves. She swabs my skin with alcohol from a bottle caked with dirt. I remember little, but I'll never forget the screams of a woman in the cot next to me. Her cry is so awful, so full of heartbreak. I think she must be dying. It would be several days before Liberian media started talking about the few people from Guinea who crossed into Lofa County seeking treatment. By then, I'd mostly recovered and continued on. Now, not a day passes when I don't think about that hospital, that week, those first Ebola patients who died there. I wonder, Did I look Ebola in the eye?
WABE's Jim Burris on the Liberia Hospital, where the first Ebola patients came for help. Jim's reporting was funded by a grant from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. But there is some good news now. Lofa County reportedly hasn't seen a new Ebola case for nearly a month.
Now, Jim didn't contract Ebola, but his symptoms, fever, diarrhea, vomiting, and muscle pain, are some of the exact symptoms of the virus.
The Ebola virus spreads from person to person through the bodily fluids of infected people who are showing symptoms, fluids like blood or human waste, and from materials contaminated with those fluids, like bedding or clothing. You can't get it through the air. But how did Ebola get to people in the first place?
Emory Professor Thomas Gillespie says the virus appears to have crossed species lines, from fruit bats to primates, especially gorillas.
In fact, the lowland gorillas are considered critically endangered by the United Nations IUCN Committee because of Ebola. And so, presumably, the gorillas, or the dikers, are getting exposed to the virus by feeding in or under a tree where the fruit bats are feeding. They're feeding on contaminated material or material that has been defecated upon by the bats. And in the process, they become infected. In the West African outbreak of Ebola that we're seeing, it's different because we're not seeing a link to gorillas or dikers. It appears to be a direct link to exposure from bats. That could be related to the fact that as areas are deforested, it's pushing bats into areas where they have more overlap with people, leading to opportunities for contamination and infection. There have been attempts over the last decades to better understand this virus and what it does in natural systems. A number of animals have been tested for Ebola, and they have not been able to isolate the virus from wildlife species. So is the reservoir a fruit bat? Maybe. Is it an ectoparasite of a fruit bat? Maybe. Is it some other organism that interacts with fruit bats in some way? Possibly.
That's Emory Professor Thomas Gillespie, a primate disease ecologist. Now, as the Ebola virus began to spread through West Africa, health and humanitarian workers were at risk of contracting Ebola.
And this summer, two American aid workers in Liberia became infected. Each would soon be transported to Atlanta's Emory University Hospital. The world saw images of how they arrived wearing containment suits, assisted by medical personnel, also in containment suits.
3 weeks after arriving in Atlanta for treatment for Ebola, American missionaries Nancy Reitbol and Dr. Kent Brantley were released from Emory University Hospital. Reitbol initially asked for privacy, but Brantley spoke to reporters immediately after his release, as we hear from Jim Burris.
With his wife by his side and a tear in his eye, a waifish Kent Brantley thanked God for his recovery. One by one, he hugged the 21 nurses and 5 doctors at Emory responsible for his care.
You treated me with expertise, yet with such tenderness and compassion. For the last 3 weeks, you have been my friends and my family. And so many of you have ministered to me not only physically, but also spiritually, which has been an important part of my recovery.
Dr. Bruce Ribner was in charge of the team caring for Brantley and Reitbol. He says it was an around-the-clock job.
At the beginning of the morning, we'd say, okay, this is what our goals are for today. And at roughly 5:30, 6 o'clock, we would say, okay, this is where we've been so far today, and this is where we're going tomorrow.
If Ebola forever changed Brantley and fellow missionary Nancy Reitbol, it also changed those treating the pair. That includes Dr. Colleen Kraft.
It's been a real privilege to do something that other people haven't done in the United States and to do it with the people that I care about as colleagues.
Brantley and Reitbol will return to Emory for follow-up care. Emory doctors say they'll pass along what they've learned from treating the pair to those fighting Ebola in West Africa.
Jim Burris on Dr. Kent Brantley's release from Emory University Hospital back in August.
And according to the World Health Organization, over 10,000 people have been infected by the Ebola virus this year. About half of those have died. Part of the reason? The healthcare systems in West Africa are overwhelmed.
And for medical workers headed to West Africa to help, the first step is proper training. That's why the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention created a special Ebola course. My colleague Michelle Aloy takes us to the CDC training site.
Good afternoon, folks. You are the clinician team. We have two patients that we need you to draw bloods on.
In a stuffy, windowless room, Dr. Naheed Bedelia briefs a few nurses and doctors on two Ebola patients. One is suspected to have the deadly disease, and the other is recovering, though not quite ready to leave.
The first step you're going to do is really assess whether it's safe for you to draw blood on this patient.
Except this treatment center isn't in West Africa. It's at an old army base in Anniston, Alabama. And the patients don't have Ebola because they're mannequins. These clinicians are taking part in the CDC's Ebola safety training course. The center's Dr. Michael Young helped develop the course and says it's the first of its kind.
We know that if we can provide training to healthcare workers, they're going to be more likely to want to deploy to West Africa, and they're going to be able to go and provide care much more safely than they would if they're not taking this course.
Almost every week from now through March, the CDC hopes to enroll around 40 nurses, doctors, and health professionals in this three-day class. The CDC isn't sending anyone directly. Young says participants must be affiliated with an NGO or the U.S. government.
So that they have a support structure when they're deployed and after they come back home.
After donning hazmat suits, goggles, gloves, masks, and rubber boots, the trainees head outside where they practice treating patients while in full protective gear. Over the next 3 days, they'll learn how to move dead, infected bodies and how to throw out vomit and feces, all major ways the disease spreads. But for today, the trainees are just focused on drawing blood, and most importantly, how to take off their contaminated protective suits. The equipment has to come off in a very specific and meticulous order, or health workers risk contaminating themselves and others. And for Miriam Schmitz and her buddy, it's off to a rocky start as they remove their masks and hoods.
Yeah, you just got your hands really close to your face. Just something to be mindful of.
I'm starting to cool off a little now.
Woo-hoo! But the hardest part is taking off the protective suit.
At this point, you don't want to touch the outside of your suit anymore, so you only want to touch the inside.
And again, Schmitz is having problems. A flap that's supposed to be covering her neck is hanging open.
You're actually going to try to open up your neck, right, and if it were closed that way.
Schmitz unzips and reaches into her suit, careful not to touch her clothes. She pushes the suit off one of her shoulders and then the next, and carefully worms her way out of the rest of it. Next, it's down to the rubber boots, which have to be sprayed down with bleach. Schmitz again makes a potentially fatal error and steps over a line separating the treatment center's high-risk area and decontaminated zone.
No, get back.
Is that the line?
Like staggered,
yeah,
that's our line.
Even in this mock exercise in, you know, southern Alabama, you can feel kind of the tension of that. You just have to get things right.
Sriram Shamasunder is a medical professor in San Francisco. He's worked in Rwanda and Haiti, but says the stakes will be higher in West Africa. Small errors could lead to death, and it's something that worries him and his wife.
Occasionally, like, I'll forget my glasses or my keys, and she'll be like, are you sure you're going to be vigilant enough to be on top of it?
Michelle Nisharenko, an ER doctor at Boston Children's Hospital, is all too aware of what mistakes can lead to. Every year, she spends a few months in Liberia training medical residents and was in the country when the first few Ebola cases broke out. She's already lost three of her Liberian colleagues.
I probably get a Facebook message every 6 hours. You know, every day the physicians there wonder, is today going to be my day? The day that my glove rips, the day that somebody doesn't triage a patient properly.
Nisharenko is returning to Liberia to get the country's existing hospitals back up and running, since many have closed as a result of the outbreak. She'll train hospital workers on how to identify and screen out Ebola patients while admitting those with other medical needs.
We've started, you know, programs for kids with asthma and kids with sickle cell disease, and those kids are out in the community with no care and nowhere to get what they need, and it just breaks my heart.
Nisharenko says she can't imagine not going to help. Her family feels differently.
If my dad could take a nail gun and staple my feet to the ground in the United States, it would have happened years ago.
Alfred Michesser is from Liberia, but moved to Minnesota a few months ago. She says trainees who haven't been to West Africa are in for a wake-up call. But Chester says leaving her two kids back in Minnesota to treat those with the disease doesn't scare her.
Not as much as not doing anything. I think if I didn't do anything, I'd be a lot more scared.
Chester is expected to leave for Liberia sometime this month.
You're listening to a WABE News special on Atlanta's response to the Ebola outbreak. I'm Dennis O'Hare.
And I'm Rose Scott. America's concerns about Ebola heightened after the first confirmed case here in the U.S. A Liberian man named Thomas Eric Duncan visited his family in Dallas, but quickly developed symptoms of Ebola. 8 days after his diagnosis, he was dead. And two nurses who treated Duncan were also diagnosed with the viral disease.
Now, this week, Georgia Governor Nathan Deal announced new policies on how to monitor and quarantine travelers coming from Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Now, that comes after Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International was designated as one of five airports where passengers from West Africa can come.
First of all, travelers will be screened by quarantine station medical personnel at the airport. The screening will include measurements of temperature and checking for symptoms of Ebola and a history of any exposure to anyone who might have been infected with the Ebola virus or individuals who may be potentially Ebola patients themselves.
Those showing symptoms will be immediately quarantined and sent to a designated state facility.
But could that deter people from wanting to work in the Ebola-stricken areas? Dr. David Satcher is the former director of the CDC and was the 16th U.S. Surgeon General. I asked him for his thoughts about these new quarantine policies.
I think it's a mistake. I don't think it's consistent with public health policy, with public health science. I think quarantine is a two-edged sword, and what it often does, it creates situations that do more harm than good. And in this case, of course, we're concerned about the fact that it will do one or two things. Number one, it will prevent a lot of people from going to help fight Ebola in West Africa in the first place. And if we don't have more people going, then we run a grave risk that this will become a pandemic. So anything that discourages people from helping to fight Ebola on the front lines over there, I think, works against what we want. Also, we know with good science that Ebola is not easily transmitted, especially before the patient shows any symptoms. So there's no really good reason to quarantine people. I think the CDC recommended the right policies.
And moving forward, what are the lessons here that have been learned or need to be learned?
Well, I think for one thing, we're learning that fear is not always rational, but it can be a very powerful weapon. And somehow I think what people are fearing is not consistent with the science. And yet I think the governors are responding to the fear of people whom they serve. So I think that's just what we're dealing with. You could argue that it would make more sense to quarantine people who had not gotten a flu shot in terms of the numbers of lives that it would save. I can't imagine that we would recommend that, because that fear is not there, and yet we know that thousands of people will die this year from influenza, thousands who would not die if they got the vaccine. And there are also people who will die because they come in contact with people who should have been vaccinated and who were not. So it's just not consistent with the best public health science.
And concerns about the Ebola virus also prompted some Metro Atlanta school districts to update their health policies for anybody coming from Ebola-affected regions. DeKalb changed its policy after two students who traveled from Liberia tried to register for school. District officials said they didn't have the right medical documents.
WABE's Martha Dalton spoke with DeKalb County Superintendent Michael Thurman about the policy change.
What does the policy specifically say?
First of all, it helps us to encourage those who are traveling from three West African countries where the center of the virus is unfolding. If, in fact, students come, parents from those areas in West Africa or any Ebola-infected area, number one, they must provide the official medical documentation that they are, in fact, virus-free prior to enrolling in the district.
how do you implement the policy without profiling students?
Well, it's difficult. What we have to do, of course, is to weigh and balance the risks associated with this very deadly disease. And we think it is within the authority and, quite frankly, just out of an abundance of caution, is the proper thing to do here in DeKalb County. The fact that we are focusing on those three countries, Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, that's exactly what the CDC, Atlanta Hartsfield International Airport, and the state of Georgia is doing. So we are in line with those policies being developed and enacted by other agencies. Well, one point, too, is not just those who are born in those countries. It's any person who may have recently traveled from those countries, anyone who may have been in the infected area. And so I don't think that in and of itself represents profiling.
There were two students who weren't enrolled when they wanted to enroll because their medical documents needed further approval. When they came to register, they had waited the 21 days. They had approval from CARE, which was the father's employer. But what did they need that they did not have?
They lacked independent medical documentation. CARE is a wonderful agency, but it's not a medical provider. And so what we asked the parents to do, to go back to the CDC or Emory, access the proper medical documentation provided to us. And once we have those in hand, we'll be more than delighted. Matter of fact, we're looking forward to the students being enrolled in the district. My top priority is to protect the health safety of students, staff, and stakeholders. And I believe at the end of the day, we've done the right thing. We've established, I think, a fair and transparent protocol. Other districts have enacted similar policies. And so I'm very satisfied with the process, with the fairness of it, and I think it's going to help us create a more safe and secure environment.
That's DeKalb County Superintendent Michael Thurman speaking with WABE's Martha Dalton. As Ebola fears grow in the U.S., some local residents from countries hardest hit by the deadly disease say they've experienced discrimination. Well, WABE's Michelle Worth spoke with members of the Liberian community right here in Atlanta.
All you have to do is say you're from a country in West Africa, and it immediately strikes fear among some in the local community. William BGK Harris came to the U.S. from Liberia in the 1970s and recently had this experience with a woman who worked at a local mall.
She followed by accident and said, you're from Liberia, huh? I said, yes, I am. She said, you're the one brought the Ebola yet.
Harris says many in his community have also been treated differently since the Ebola crisis started. Harris knows because he's the pastor of International Christian Fellowship here in Atlanta. He says members of his church have also faced discrimination at work and in public places.
They're afraid. They will ask you a question that, who you been around? How many relatives of yours have come?
Some in Harris's congregation have also been told by employers to go home if they have a cough or a cold. He says the backlash against West Africans was so bad in one instance, a nurse in his congregation quit her job.
That is very sad. I mean, you know, for imagine you've been working to a place for a long time, and it had nothing to do with your performance.
And even as they face discrimination here, Harris says his congregation is worried about friends and family in Liberia.
Some members of the church have relatives who died, and that's been very disturbing.
That concern was apparent this past Sunday. That's when Harris asked for prayers for Liberia and other parts of West Africa that are struggling with Ebola.
We just heard that in Mali now they got one case of a little girl that died.
Reverend Simeon Tomasifa works with Harris and had a Liberian family member die during the Ebola crisis. He's also felt stigmatized in recent months, like the time Sifa tried to hand his landlord a check.
I was trying to give her a check. She didn't want to hold it because she thinks that I'm from Liberia.
And at a local mechanic shop, Sifa says an employee heard his accent and asked where he was from. At that point, Sifa says he wanted to say he was from another African country not affected by Ebola.
I almost told him I was from Burkina Faso. Because as soon as you say Liberia, right there you stigmatize.
Instead, Sifa gave the employee his passport, and the man told everyone in the shop Sifa was from Liberia. They stared fearfully at him, which he says made him feel ashamed.
The CDC has received a lot of criticism over how it laid out its guidelines for healthcare workers treating Ebola patients. Many health officials complained the protocols were vague or that they didn't go far enough to protect hospital staff. Now, the two nurses who treated Thomas Eric Duncan in Dallas caught the disease, prompting the CDC to strengthen the guidelines. Now, one of those nurses, Amber Vinson, was treated at Emory University Hospital and was just released yesterday. As WABE's Jim Burris reports, it's the fourth straight success story for Emory's Ebola team.
Ember Vinson arrived at Emory less than 2 weeks ago. As she left an afternoon news conference to head back to Texas, Vinson hugged and thanked each of the hospital's Ebola treatment team.
As a nurse, and now as someone who has experienced what it's like to be cared for through a life-threatening illness, I am so appreciative and grateful for your exceptional skill, warmth, and care.
Emory doctors say they've learned a lot about treating Ebola since the first two patients arrived there nearly 3 months ago. Dr. Bruce Ribner heads Emory's Ebola team.
The general dogma in our industry in July was that if patients got so ill that they required dialysis or ventilator support, there was no purpose in doing those interventions because they would invariably die.
Ribner says Emory proved aggressively treating the disease is effective. But the 29-year-old Benson seemed to recover especially quickly. Ribner says they're not exactly sure why. They think her age played a role, and though much attention has been paid to the failure of her personal protective equipment, Ribner says it probably helped.
It is quite likely that the amount of virus that she was exposed to was substantially less than what we see in patients who get infected in less developed countries.
Ribner says Amber Vinson is completely free of the Ebola virus and, like the other Ebola patients Emory has treated, poses no public health threat.
So how big is Emory's Ebola team? Well, there are 5 infectious disease doctors, 21 nurses, 2 pathologists, and 5 medical technicians.
There's still a lot more work to be done in stopping the spread of the Ebola virus.
And health officials recognize it could take a while.
WABE will continue to cover the latest news about the Ebola virus and how Atlanta is responding. For WABE, I'm Dennis O'Hare.
And I'm Rose Scott. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a special broadcast on the Ebola outbreak. Thanks to Emory University Hospital, WABE reporters Jim Burris, Michelle Alloy, Martha Dalton, and Michelle Wirth, WABE News Director John Haas, and the entire WABE News team, Public Broadcasting Atlanta's Digital Services team, researcher Rob Aaron, your hosts Dennis O'Hare and Rose Scott, production assistants from Stephanie Stokes and Aaron Wright. To hear this radio documentary again and for additional features, visit wabe.org/Ebola.